Are you nervous about AI taking away work? Or I think no. I think it's going to change our jobs and it's going to change what we do. But the value that we truly add is that value judgment, that knowledge base, that experience that you're bringing into your role. And I think that human touch, that human element of it is really what adds our value. And I think that's not going to be taken away.
They keep telling us that it's all over for HR. The age of AI is upon us, and that means HR should be prepared to be decimated. We reject that message. The future of HR won't be handed to us. Instead, it'll be defined by those ready to experiment, adopt, and adapt. Future-Proof HR invites these builders to share what they're trying, how it's going, what they've learned, and what's next. We are committed to arming HR with the AI insights to not just survive, but to thrive. Hello and welcome to the Future Proof HR podcast, where we explore how forward-thinking HR leaders are preparing for disruption and redefining what it means to lead people in a changing world. I'm your host, Thomas Kunjapu, CEO of Cleary. Today's guest is Fernando Garcia, Chief People and Legal Officer at Opta Group. With 15 plus years of experience across general counsel, HR and labor relations, compliance and corporate secretary roles, plus a BA in labor studies, a master's in industrial relations and HR, dual civil and common law degrees, and an MBA in strategic management. I think it's fair to say Fernando brings a rare T-shaped blend of legal depth and business people breadth. So he leads at the intersection of law, business, and innovation, and advocates for pragmatic adoption of legal and HR tech to unlock efficiency while at the same time managing risk. Fernando, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and looking forward to our conversation.
Absolutely. So I'd love to set up our conversation with this concept of the three-legged stool I think we were talking about a bit earlier. We've got business, legal risk management, and people. Now, you've pursued degrees and have worked in kind of a combination of all three. How do you see that all coming together?
When I look at what makes a business successful, I think, you know, and looking back at it, when I first started my career, I thought there were three elements. One is obviously the people. So the HR part is critical. That is what distinguishes one company from another. That is what makes a place attractive for someone to go work at and stay there. The other part is legal. We're all involved in an environment of laws and regulations and compliance. And that affects how we do our job. That affects how companies go to business and which companies are successful. And then obviously the business component of it, the business strategy, the planning, and making sure your products are meeting the needs of society and they're adapting as necessary to be able to be successful in your environment or your market. So when I was looking and I'm thinking, well, how do I want to shape my career moving forward? I thought those are three elements that I really wanted to touch on, become experienced in, and really gather experience. So one was the educational background, which you read already and was quite exciting. I mean, my wife always complains that if I could, I would be a lifetime student. And I think in many ways, we are all lifetime students. We never stop learning. We never stop developing. We never stop growing. And if we do, that's when things get boring. So we're always looking at that. But those are three areas that are of interest to me in terms of education, but also in terms of what I do on a day-to-day basis. I don't want to be just a lawyer. And I don't want to be just an HR person. I want to be a business person with an HR and legal background.
I love that concept of combining these two. So it's like one seat, two functions. But tell me where you see the strongest synergies between specifically HR and legal. I mean, my mind and probably everyone's mind goes to like employee relations and like just, you know, making sure that you're, you know, firing and doing things in a compliant way, right? And right. On the people side. Tell me about how you see the two coming together in your day-to-day.
Well, I think a lot of it is also risk management. I mean, some of those elements that you mentioned are very important on a day-to-day, you know, making sure you avoid litigation, making sure you're following proper processes and hiring, firing, and all those day-to-day things of HR. But there's an element of HR that looks longer term, more strategic, more longer term value based. And the legal environment and the legal background also helps you mitigate risk in the long run. So helping strengthen your brand and making your brand stronger, both locally and internationally, and understanding what are the things that are going to impact it so that you can be successful in that environment. And part of that is, a huge part of it is having the right people, you know, in the right jobs, and feeling like they want to stay and be developed, have their skill set acknowledged and really fully developed within the corporation. So it's in the short term and in the long run that I think there's a tons of synergies between HR and legal itself.
When you say short term and long run, what do you mean? You mean like in day-to-day tactical things, but also—
Absolutely. You know, if something happens, I need, you know, support, or I need your advice regarding this particular issue that we're dealing with today. But also thinking more longer term in terms of where businesses are going, and, you know, what are some of the unique needs of, you know, risk mitigation and development and all the fun stuff. And, you know, AI walks right into that.
Okay, let me ask you some advice, for some advice, because a lot of HR leaders don't have your background in and training in law, but of course are very much in the weeds, or their teams are in compliance, right?
Yes.
So what have you seen as the, or what would be your advice for HR leaders in terms of like how they can best work with the legal department?
Yeah, I think it's also a function of how the mindset of your legal department. You know, there's legal departments that are, like I always say, the people who are in charge of forms 347C, and all they do is 347C, and if you have a legal question about that form, you go to them. But then there's also the legal departments, and what's I've been advocating for a long time. You kind of mentioned it, the T-shaped lawyer, or I called it the plus-shaped lawyer in one of my articles that I wrote many, many years ago now, that it's not just being a legal department that handles legal questions, but that it's part of the business, integrated to the business. And if that's the particular case, I mean, I think in HR and legal working together really help to fill the voids and mitigate risk, which is at the end of the day very important for us and for anyone really operating in an environment, right? Because you don't want to create any kind of potential situation or, you know, risks in the environment or to the company.
If you're talking to like your friends, colleagues in HR who
yes.
Who are not obviously lawyers as well, and like what are the kinds of things that were you or like situations? Do any situations come to mind where you feel like this was? I wish in this case the HR department had like checked in or worked more closely with legal. And are there any kind of kinds of situations that keep coming up in your mind where, you know, the HR function could just kind of work more tightly with the legal department?
Well, I think, you know, if you look at your legal team as a business strategic advisor and really part of the business itself, then you get them involved early on. The biggest issue or what I look at, one of the greatest limitations is when you get involved with legal too late. Once something has already blown up, once something's already, you know, a conflict or there's a potential litigation issue, at that point it's much harder because your tools or the available outcomes are already much more limited. But if you get them involved early on, if the relationship is one of constant communication, interaction, and working together on things, you can be proactive and address the issues before they even become issues. And that's, I think, where when you add the most value, because you're working hand in hand. And again, and I've seen many situations of people who are lawyers who go and take on functions in terms of HR. And I've seen the other way around too, HR people who are very specialized, especially in areas like labor relations, but then they go and they take on sort of a quasi legal function, even sure. within their organization. So it kind of goes both ways, but yeah, I tend yeah. to find that there's a lot of synergies there in terms of the functions and the roles that we play.
So you talked a little bit about that mindset then, the T-shaped mindset, but also the ability to be like a focus on the business outcome, like right. regardless of kind of like function. So it sounds like that might apply equally to HR, legal on both sides, right? You also mentioned how that mindset may be actually even like a perfectly fit for the age of AI. So nice. Tell me about that from both perspectives, and especially from a risk mitigation and compliance perspective, which is what we've been talking about so far, right? How do you think about AI, especially with that mindset of being, you know, flexible, agile, T-shaped?
Yeah, I mean, I think AI brings another element to our toolkit, and it's a critical tool in terms of helping take away maybe some of the more administrative functions or responsibilities and really focusing more on the value added giving you another person that you, it's almost like a virtual person that you can run ideas by and come up with alternatives. Now, again, it's not, I wouldn't say it's a professional at par, because I think there's still some development to go. And you got to be somewhat critical, and you got to be careful about what information is given to you and how you're using that information. So you still have to check it, and you still have to go do your due diligence. Sure. But I think it's a critical tool in terms of helping take away some of the more, you know, labor-intensive administrative functions, and really helping you focus on where you can add the greatest value in terms of your organization and even your function itself. With the caveat that you got to be careful with it as well. And
so, let's get very specific then. Like, what's your safe list? The more exciting things to talk about is like, don't do this. These areas are just like, you know, got to be really careful about with AI. But how do you, or right. Maybe you can kind of answer both. Like, how do you think of it? What is safe? What are you going to go into? What's okay to experiment with versus where do you really need to, you know, be careful?
Yeah, I mean, I think you like anything, and I don't want to give you the lawyer answer, but it depends. Really, the fundamental here is make sure that you're understanding the terms and conditions in terms of what you're using. You're putting in private information, make sure that you understand that it stays contained, and work with the IT department to make sure it's a closed system versus the information you're putting in all of a sudden becomes part of the public domain. You're putting in, you know, sensitive employee information in there, possible health information, which is obviously a bit on some of the other concerns that you have in that particular case. But if you have all that covered up and that issue is not a concern, it does open up the possibilities in terms of how you can use it. Just mindful of, you know, whatever information you put in there, you have to double check, you have to review, it's safe. You're not going to have loss of privilege issues, or you're putting out personal information onto the domain. But in terms of that element of it, I think there's a lot of opportunities too, in terms of, you know, recruiting, in terms of drafting letters, in terms of just really sometimes even just getting you started. But the key is you still have to review it, because it does tend to hallucinate at times. And, you know, there's also the concept of garbage in is garbage out, right? So you have to make sure that whatever how you're prompting it or what information you're feeding it is going to affect what the outcome is. And you got to be mindful of that part of it as well.
So I guess there's a lot to consider there. It sounds like, I think you're saying there's a clear set in your mind of areas you have to like make sure that you're bulletproof on in terms of risk mitigation, right? And 100%. Data privacy. And once that's in place, would you say that's pretty universal, or is it really, in your view, kind of, you know, besides cultural expectations where some companies are more AI forward versus, or innovative versus others, yeah. Do you just feel like there's like a kind of a generic sense of, you know, set of guardrails across all industries, across all companies? Like, hey, no training with this data for the core LLM models. There's some kind of like onboarding and training for every employee who's going to have access to these things. Yes. PII or customer data should not be on this, or this is the specific like guardrails, and there's trainings on that. You know, there's like a set of things you could come up with. And do you feel like that's like pretty universal, and really the only gap is cultural? Or in your view, like from what you can tell, it's just like every industry is like different, and you really have like nuances about what is what the guardrails are.
I think it's beyond just every industry. I think every company, every location is in a sort of a different stage in their journey. Mm. And some people are still very much experimental. Some people are, you know, all in, and they want all their employees to have access, all their employees to be properly trained and all that place. The reality though is that most people, whether it's on a personal basis or at work, are using something. And so you have to make sure you train them up in terms of saying, well, look, if you don't have the proper guardrails in place, still use it, but be mindful. Don't put employee information in there. Don't put names. Don't put personal information. Don't put stuff about products that haven't been released to the public yet. Don't put market share data or sensitive pricing information. Unless you are at that stage where you've now checked the box and everything's okay and there isn't that risk element on there. Every company, every location will be at a different stage of that journey. But I think the biggest risk of them all is assuming that nobody in your company or no employees using AI. Because I think more and more, whether it's just to write a greeting card or to start an email or really to check a report or review something or even draft, you know, initial stages of reports, people are using it. So you have to be mindful of that, and you have to be mindful of how knowledgeable are they of it and how can they protect the information as much as possible. So some minor training, I think, is critical regardless of where you are in that journey.
Yeah, so regardless of whether you've adopted wall-to-wall some kind of like LLM enterprise solution or not, in all likelihood, someone out there is using
They're using it.
In previous 100%. Years, we'd had this concept called like shadow IT, and that when SaaS was first coming into the fore, and now there's like shadow AI, right? That there's like usage like happening, and it's similar things. Like your data could be leaking without the yes. right kind of guardrails. I'm very curious, given your two halves here, where do you think there's more been more adoption of AI tools within the legal kind of community for all types of contract law, employee law, there's all types of paralegal type of work, or in the HR world, which, you know, our audience obviously like knows a lot about. But do you think there's an emergent any differences in terms of adoptions, or like if you see like the different communities that you're traveling in, like just the general stance towards these tools?
Yeah, I think even, for example, if you're talking about the legal industry, I think you can break it up into two parts, because you have the in-house counsel and then you have sort of the external lawyers who work for big law firms. The big law firms tend to have more resources, tend to have more training, tend to have more of that, you know, giving them the tools and having the parameters properly crossed. I think, you know, in-house counsels, depending on the size of the companies they work at, you know, they can have that available to employees and training and everything else, or you could be in a smaller organization where there's less of that training. So, but I think, you know, in HR, same concept. You know, I hear from people who are very much just drafting emails with it or doing some preliminary, to people who are getting, you know, 100 resumes for a particular role, and they run a preliminary search through the 100 resumes, say, pick me the top 10 based on the following job description. But again, you got to be very mindful of that as well, that, you know, you got to be careful that you're still doing that, your proper check and your proper due diligence, because, you know, I hate to be in a situation where people are using AI to, you know, create their resumes, then they're using AI to check amongst the resumes to see which is the best one, to then check it against the job description that was developed by AI. And you know, at the end of the day, AI is just doing your recruiting, and it takes away that human element, which is, I think, at the end of the day, critical. I mean, what a resume shows or what a resume provides doesn't necessarily mean that person is going to be a good fit within the environment, within the industry they work in, and that they're going to be successful.
Well, the part that you're missing in that equation is that the candidate pool is also not standing still, and that resume that these AI tools are reviewing are half-generated, customized in response to the AI-generated job description to give it a, you know, a great likelihood of advancing to the next stage.
Yeah.
And there's just, you know, AI tools fighting AI tools, and there's just like volume of applications jumping up like dramatically in all types of roles.
Oh, yes. I've seen that. That's definitely a trend that you're seeing, that for any role where you might have had 20, 25 applicants, now you're getting 200, which makes it even more important to have a tool to go through and use the initial process to try to narrow it down and to focus on it. But again, you just got to be very careful in terms of what it is doing, and that you're still having an element of human judgment and discretion in it. Because yeah, I think so, that's where you add the value.
I think you're getting to a key, almost ethical concept, arguably, right? Which is sitting at the intersection here, about fairness, right? And really about like bias avoidance. Mm-hmm. It's very obvious as a concept in the recruiting process, but, you know, also in performance management, all the way to performance improvement processes, and like, you know, firing situations as well.
Yes.
But it's across the board, like important as AI tools get into, you know, into the workflows here, right? So, yeah, how do you think about the ethical side of it? Besides the efficiency and besides the legal ramifications, like, how do you even like you know, think through? And we can take any one of those like use cases and like think through a little bit together the ethical consequences of leveraging AI, for, whether there's bias or judgment that you're now outsourcing to artificial intelligence.
Yeah, it's interesting because you get people who are on both sides of the equation, right? There are some people that say that the more you use the AI, the more you take away the potential bias of a person who's doing the review.
Right.
Whereby other people say, well, hold on a second, somebody has programmed it or it's learned from something. It just doesn't come up with these concepts and the training. So somebody at some point trained it, and then the biases or the experiences or whatever else of that training element, wherever it's coming from, it will creep into the decision-making. So it's almost like one of those, you know, dilemmas, right? Like, is it taking away the bias by using more AI, or is it just perpetuating the bias by using the tool that was created by somebody who obviously had bias? And at what point do you minimize that and you get the best result?
Right. Well, that's a great question. I mean, in the world of self-driving cars, you have a specific outcome where you're trying to reduce accidents and make sure that streets are safer, right? And
yes.
You have an outcome metric that can be relatively objective. Maybe the issue in hiring is that the outcome metric is like, who judges the outcome in this case? Like, you know, fatalities is like, it's like an objective measure, and there's like data that you can get that you can trust. In this case, it's like, well, you can make hires, but is it a good hire? Was it the right hire? Do we miss other people? There's so many other aspects to it. And at least this one facet, arguably, you know, hiring humans is more of a, it's a tougher solve, right? To really get to clarity in what is the best outcome. But you mentioned these both sides of the argument. Are you convinced or swayed by either side, or
I'm cautious of both sides? I want to remain cautious and knowledgeable that there are risks and there are limitations both ends. And you mentioned the autonomous vehicles, for example, but you know, even that has a bias. And there's a great website. I'm trying to remember the name of it. It's by MIT, and I think it's called Moral Machines. And it basically says this: you're driving your autonomous vehicle, and you know, you come to a situation. The autonomous vehicle is driving itself, and it comes to a situation where it must decide, you know, is it going to get into an accident and kill the occupant, or is it going to kill one person who's crossing the street? Well, what if it's two people crossing the street versus one occupant? Well, what if it's other people crossing the street and two young children in the car? And it starts creating all these moral dilemmas in terms of saying, well, at some point, something's got to decide. And, you know, depending on what your value is, you know, if you're a car company that comes out and says, as of 2030, I'm going to have zero occupancy deaths in my car, then that means that when it has to make that moral decision, it's going to obviously prioritize the safety and well-being of the people in the car versus the ones who are crossing the street and getting to an awkward situation. So I think even when you're looking at something as autonomous vehicles, there's still a value judgment that will come into play. And you know, I can totally see it that, you know, at some point I'll say, whoa, I don't know, I can't make that moral decision for you. Here's a steering wheel back to you decide. Are you going to put yourself in a ditch, or are you going to run over the two people who are crossing the street, you know, maybe jaywalking or something else? So even at that level, even like autonomous vehicles, that technology still will have an element of bias to it.
Fair point. I mean, you're talking about the trolley problem, but instead of deciding between like two different, like two outcomes. External parties and a human deciding, it's an AI deciding.
Right.
I mean, in this case, like a customer who bought their product and like, you know, someone else, but that's a tricky, dilemma to get into. And the outcome, or like the escape valve, let's call it, is that, well, okay, we don't know. Let's let the human needs to decide, right? So
exactly.
In the recruiting world, if we come back to what we're talking about, it's like we need to let the recruiter or the manager with all the human flaws and all, you know, we're going to attribute it to this person so that we can move it out of the hands of a machine.
Because you can do all the behavioral testing you want, and you can do all the testing and, you know, AI reviews. But at the end of the day, having that person meet, whether virtually or in person, with the team, and seeing that interaction, seeing how they're going to fit in, seeing how well they're going to thrive within that environment, nothing will replicate that. That is why I, you know, people always say, are you nervous about AI taking away work, or you know, I think no. I think it's going to change our jobs and it's going to change what we do. But the value that we truly add is that value judgment, that knowledge base, that experience that you're bringing into your role. And I think that human touch, that human element of it is really what adds our value. And I think that's not really going to be taken away. There might be less, you know, labor intensive elements of it. And there's going to be questions about how do you get people trained and, you know, make sure that when you're using AI, you're not just parking your brain at the door, but you're still sort of being critical and you're using it properly and you're learning how to prompt, but you're also learning how to apply the knowledge. But at the end of the day, I think that is truly where we add value, is the human piece. And I think that's never going to go away.
This has been a fantastic conversation so far. If you haven't already done so, make sure to join our community. We're building a network of the most forward-thinking HR and people operations professionals who are defining the future. I will personally be sharing news and ideas around how we can all thrive in the age of AI. You can find it at gocleary.com/cleary-community. Now back to the show. So how do you imagine that transition happening then? So that folks, and let's focus on like the HR department as a whole. You said maybe we're not going to be spending as much time on the administrative elements of it and the repetitive tasks. So how do you imagine going from like today to like, what does that future state look like?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, if you gain the 200 resumes for that single job, you can cut it down to 15 using the AI, and then understanding that within those 15, you still have to go in there, do the review, meet them, do the screening, you know, get to see how they're going to apply in your workplace and how they're going to thrive within it and what value that we're going to add to it. I think that that's part of it. So it'll help you get partially there, but you still have to drive it home at the end. And you still have to use your judgment on that part.
So are we okay with the moral hazard of AI eliminating 90 out of 100 resumes? Is that going to be unbiased? Because what we're saying is like, at least for that one phase of the application process, then we are okay with the trolley problem, whatever value judgment that we're maybe helping program into the AI, but you know, we're going to use that to make some judgment, right? And then continue onwards. Ultimately, it's a practicality, I feel like, for a lot of recruiting teams, because if you have 1,000 resumes, like, what do you...
It's a necessity, right?
Right. So do you kind of escape the ethical problem because of the necessity?
I think you have to be aware of the ethical problem, and you have to be aware of the potential risks associated with it. And then at that point, I think it depends on the role, right? If it's a critical role, then maybe you say, look, this is such an important role that I will go through the 200 resume. Some other one that maybe isn't as critical, or one that maybe isn't, you know, the fit is not as important, or who knows, whatever the parameters are, maybe that one requires a little bit more, or allows you a little bit more space in that. But again, I think there are elements that you always have to be aware of, and the biases are there. And but again, I think there are risks both sides, because of the bias of a person reviewing the resumes could also be as important as the bias in the technology, or how we're separating it, or doing the first cut through AI. You're never going to completely eliminate it, I think, regardless of the two. Just got to be aware of it. You got to be mindful of it.
One idea I had as you're saying that is that the roles which the organization has hired like hundreds of in the past,
right?
You've had like over many years, and it's like the same kind of background that's successful, and you've established that qualitatively and quantitatively, right? So these are all input into like whatever you're using for screening as an AI tool. So the more, I guess, validated specific input data you have on a specific decision, the more maybe you've controlled bias, and maybe more comfortable ethically, you know, moving efficiency around versus hiring for the first time for a role ever in a new context. You just literally don't know, right? What is the background, or like what are the set of characters that a resume can say that actually represent success if it's never been done, especially this organization before?
But I mean, again, there's no single answer and no single right answer, because again, you know, you always hear that the most dangerous words are, we've always done it that way. So just because you always hired this way and obtained this level of performance, you don't know if taking, you know, a different approach or hiring people maybe who are not normally the people you would hire for that particular role is not going to elevate the level of performance. So you also have to every once in a while just break out from that, you know, the trend, and be able to think outside the box, and, you know, maybe go outside of the areas that you normally hire from, maybe go outside of the colleges that you normally hire from, or whatever, because that is how you identify potential value that might have otherwise been lost. And I think that's where, you know, the AI could maybe fail, because it does look at trending, it does look at what have you done, and it establishes a baseline, but sometimes you want to go above and beyond that baseline. And I think that's when, you know, be it lawyer or anything else, the creativity of a novel argument or some additional way of looking at something which has not been done before is when you're truly adding value and you're elevating that performance from what is normally you're accustomed to. And the question is, will AI ever get to the point where it can do that additional critical thinking or jump to say, this is what you've always done, this is what you've always achieved, but if you do something different, you might be able to get here now. Because we tend to learn from the past, we tend to replicate the results. But the question is, it starts getting to a point where it's now cognitive and it's starting to make, it's, you know, learn and, you know, go beyond just the confines of the past or previous decisions. That's when it starts getting interesting.
Right. Like incorporating new data about like what the business needs now, for example, or like what's the risk analysis. Now. And yeah, absolutely.
How much risk is your company willing to take in this role to say, look, maybe we go outside of the normal beaten path and maybe look for a purple unicorn, or it was a purple squirrel, as they call it, right? Uh-huh. An additional person. And sometimes you got to go outside of that to find it.
Let's get a little bit practical then. Can you tell me about the key workflows, use cases that you've personally seen like some success in, and maybe others that you're excited about where AI can start changing the way work is done?
Yeah, I mean, some of the interesting functions I've seen or applications are, you know, reviewing things like employee surveys, finding trends and identifying things that maybe you need to focus on, developing training programs for individuals. You know, you can sort of go in there and say, look, this is where I'm having a gap. How do you recommend it? You know, training, it can help you develop training programs. Mm-hmm. We talked about the recruiting, obviously, that's a critical one. Job descriptions, you know, helping you take that initial draft and the things that you do, the letters, you know, you have a termination coming up and all of a sudden you're last minute rushing it. It can help you get the first draft going and then you can perfect it. So I think, you know, people are starting to get curious, people are starting to use it. You know, companies are developing pilot projects and getting individuals who are trained to start applying it. And then once they see an element of success and comfort, and they start adopting it to greater numbers. Everybody's handling it differently. But the beauty is people are looking at it, right? And again, challenging the status quo in many ways and just trying to be more value and doing more with less, which is, I think, you know, the reality of all of our jobs and all of our functions.
So tell me more about that. What are you seeing within the world of like HR specifically around this concept of doing more with less? Is that seeming like universal, like with your peers? What's the solution here? Like how do we get to the point of like being productive and getting resource enough to be able to do that?
Yeah, I think there are those who are the trendsetters who are using it more. And then, you know, you go to a conference or you go to an event and you start talking to other people. This is what I've done with it. This is how I used it. Mm-hmm. Somebody else goes, that's actually a pretty good idea. Maybe I'll try that. Right. So the critical element of this is, you know, the people who are going to be the trendsetters and the people who are going to be able to adopt best practices or learn from what others are doing and start implementing in their own play in their own way. But the key is just being curious, you know, using, you know, experimentation, bringing things in and doing things differently with the AI and where it's going in technology. But again, AI is one element, but it's not the only element, right? There's information that you're taking from HRS systems, from contract management systems. Data is power, and information and technologies is critical to the best in their functions.
So if that's where things are headed, like what do you think are the kinds of people or skill sets that are coming into the fore who are going to be more effective going into the future? A lot of what we try to talk about is future-proofing, right?
In
whatever function. And actually, maybe let me ask a specific question. Is it getting to the point where job descriptions are starting to more heavily feature, you know, either the ability to learn, like rethink how you're doing workflows, and or all the way up to demonstrated experience in leveraging AI to bring out efficiencies?
I haven't seen a lot of that yet. I think I've seen that in terms of jobs that are heavy with AI or that are involved in fintech or some of those things like that, where that's a critical component right now. Mm-hmm. But I think at some point, I wouldn't be surprising to start seeing things like, experience in AI, a prefer, or even then, you know, making the assumption that maybe people are not coming in with that, but really focusing on training that skill set. Because I think, you know, companies can do a really good job in terms of, you know, helping people develop and get comfortable and see how that can apply, whether it's through mentorship, you know, with people who are in the industry or in your department when you come in and they can help you. Look, this is how I'm using it. How are you using it? Things like, you know, lunchtime training sessions and sharing your best practices and tips, prompting, things like that. I think that they're critical. So it's a question of, do you buy it or you make it? And, you know, for some, I think it's going to become more and more visible that, you know, they put that as a preference. But I think that at the same time, people are saying, well, look, let's train up. Let's get this is a skill set that we're developing. No different than leadership training or any other kind of training that we do on a daily basis. That we can do, AI or efficiency training or adaptive technology training. Because again, it's going to be a critical competitive advantage one day.
So if that's true, how do you square that? And I would imagine we'd agree that the enablement of that for the organization is primarily going to be done through the HR department. There's some like individual on every functional level, people comparing notes, but if you're trying to enable the entire org and strategically up-level it for some ROI, how do you square that with fewer resources to make it so?
It's one of those where you investor need to get the benefit after. But again, it doesn't have to be expensive. I mean, you can get somebody who's very knowledgeable in AI or very comfortable with it that can just do a lunch hour session saying, hey, here's some peeks on the side and come sit down. Let's go through some examples of how I'm using this. So it doesn't
have you seen the food inflation? But okay. But I'm with you though.
Granted. So I mean, there's formal training, but then there's training that can happen peer to peer. There's sort of train the trainer concepts and just, you know, like within associations, industries, you know, conferences, sharing best practices, sharing tips. I tend to find that that's really, really important. When I first became, how can I say this, comfortable with the AI, that's how it happened. I went to a conference and we had a session on, this is what I'm using it for. These are my tips to you. And now I was like, wow, I can do so much with that. So it's really having those people who are early champions, early adopters, and then having them share their knowledge and experiences with others within their industry, within the company, and just amongst their peers.
As people are sharing and like learning and upskilling, do you imagine new roles and titles might even appear, especially within like HR and legal, I don't know, within the compliance or employee relations world or within recruiting or, you know, just...
I totally see that, right? In terms of... You know, we had HRIS type, individuals who are in charge of data and putting in and analyzing. I could totally see as
like system as configuration.
Yeah, configuration and development and, you know. But I took a stat here. It was from the Conference Board of Canada. It said that 4 in 10 HR teams are using some sort of AI for talent management. So just looking at that number again, 4 out of 10, it's not a lot, but it's a number. I mean, 4 is getting to that critical mass point where, you know, as long as they can start sharing their past practice and their learnings with the other 6, you'll slowly start seeing that shift the other way. And I wouldn't be surprised if 10 years from now, we're looking at the number where like 8 in 10 or 9 in 10 are using it, because I think it's a tool. It's no different than, you know, when computers came up. You know, I remember working at a law firm, and for the most part, most lawyers were using computers. But there were still a few who decided to have, you know, the dictaphone, and they were still dictating their notes and then having someone else type it up for them. So it took a while to get there. I don't think you'll see that anywhere else in the firms anymore, anywhere. But there's that transition period that has to happen until, you know, there are people who are going to be extremely comfortable with saying, look, hey, I'm curious. I want to learn. I want to develop myself and I want to do it. And there's others who are saying, well, hold on a second. I'm fairly confident in what I'm doing. I don't need that tool. So they're going to be more resistant to change. But like anything, like any change effort, right? There's going to be those who take the change head on and those who are going to be more resistant to the change. You just have to start persuading them of why it's important, how they can improve their performance by using it, and how, you know, maybe they're more worried about the repercussions or the risks, how you're mitigating those risks and training them to do that.
It's funny, maybe the dictaphone people were actually ahead of their time. Because if you look at what's happening now, no one's typing up notes.
No.
Like for future focus, you're actually having an AI transcription happening off of the call to then summarize and kind of go further, which then you might like review, which is closer in some ways, right, to the voice dictation, which then is manually written up. If we kind of imagine that 4 to 10 gets to be like more like 10 out of 10, like eventually over time. What do you think, and to your point, yes, like AI, it's a tool, right? It's a tool set that you can leverage, humans can and will leverage. It's kind of the next phase of technology. But if you just focus on the humans for a moment, right? You know, what is the advice that you have for someone who's young and just coming out of school, maybe looking to go into HR, maybe even considering law school, right? And is just trying to think about like what they should be like what skill sets they should really be like trying to focus on to make sure that they're employable in the future. What advice would you have for them?
Yeah, I always say, you know, try to focus on getting the broader or as broad of a skill set as possible. And, you know, the, the curiosity and the use of technology is one of them, but don't lose track of the ability to network, the ability to build human connections and interactions, to be able to work with people. You know, the emotional intelligence is critical in terms of everything that we do in HR, legal, or anything else that we do. And it goes back to that T-shaped concept, right? Where, you know, your legal or your HR knowledge could be this, but then there's a whole horizontal piece where there's all these other skill sets that it's so critical for you to have, whether it's project management skill sets or other relationship building or dealing with diverse and international workforces. That there's all these things that add value to you as a person that are not going to be just technology. And so you got to be careful not to be just the person who focuses on, hey, technology is helping you do A, but what else are you doing? How else are you going to bring your skill set? And how else are you contributing and adding value to it? Technology is going to help us get to a certain point, but the human piece is always what's going to take you above and beyond that and make you successful and adaptable and adding value to whatever organization you're in or whatever function or task or role you're taking on.
That's a great advice and seems like timeless, right, in some ways. But then while I have you, I have to ask, Fernando, before I let you go, as you're looking in the horizon of the next couple of years, right, is there anything in general that you're a project that you're working on or a concept that you feel like is going to come to fruition that you're particularly passionate about that you'd be willing to share?
It's interesting. Personally, I've been working a lot in terms of the legal industry, in terms of making sure that, you know, we think of ourselves as the expressions in-house counsel more as business, you know, business executives with a legal background or an HR background, and really thinking about how we're adding value to our organization, how we're helping people grow within the industry or within our companies, how we're identifying talent, how we're helping those talents stay. I think there isn't one particular area, but I think it's more about how holistically we're all becoming a little bit more knowledgeable, a little bit more skilled, and how we're incorporating all those skill sets to do better work and to make sure that, you know, we truly see that, you know, people value, people matter. And that's one of our strengths, and we're adopting all these tools. Because the one risk of technology is if you stick to it too much, it might dehumanize you. And that, I think at the end of the day, that human element of it will never go out of style, will never be something that doesn't add value. That's not something we should ever stop developing.
I love that thought, and it's something I can personally relate to. And having wonderful conversations like this on this podcast has, I feel like, humanized me more personally. Like I'm like, in terms of like having conversations, because, you know, working in the software and like AI world, constantly you're just kind of honed in there. But this helps you keep that human connection, no matter what it is that you're doing. So thank you for this conversation, Fernando, because we covered a lot of ground from some, I didn't expect to go into the trolley problem where the remix is that AI is making the decision and you are the, you know, one of the lives, not these others. And relating that to talent acquisition funnel, you know, problems, but it's really interesting how you're kind of looking at things from a legal customer contract and, you know, compliance perspective, while also very much keeping the HR hat on. And I would think that maybe you could put finance in there as well. But, you know, these are the functions that typically are the most risk averse, I think it's fair to say,
yes,
in an organization. And maybe by design, sales and marketing and the CEO is supposed to push for, you know, new boundaries. Right. And you're trying to say, hey, like, maybe you don't want to do that because we'll get sued and we got to hold back. But it's really refreshing to think about to hear about your nuanced position, because even if that's true, you're very much like an early adopter of AI tools, which have ethical and efficiency issues and trade-offs, but simply cannot be ignored. And, you know, I like the nuance in our conversation, right? Where it's, you know, every company and every role might have a different nuance for how you might use AI versus people. And that probably goes more broadly. And it's really important to weigh those things, even though you have some fixed guardrails to get started with. And thanks for going through some of those, because I think a lot of companies are just like getting in the early stages of that journey of figuring out how to go wall to wall or enable people. And so I think that'll be helpful for folks who are out there listening, who are looking to future-proof their own functions in HR, but also their organizations overall. So thank you once again, Fernando, for the conversation.
Thank you. And it'll be interesting. 5 years from now, we'll look back on this and say, wow, you know, we either got it right or we completely missed the boat, or you know, technology and AI started developing completely different ways, and you know, the applications were something that we never thought about. But it's an interesting time. And you know, if I can say anything, it's just stay curious, you know, experiment, and you know, do it safely and do it within, you know, the guardrails, but do it, because it's an exciting time. We have an incredible tool that we're seeing develop from Verizon. It's growing exponentially, and you know, you don't want to miss out on that.
Absolutely. So let's leave it there. So thank you, and
thank you
everyone out there. We'll see you on the next one. Bye now. Thanks for joining us on this episode of Future Proof HR. If you like the discussion, make sure you leave us a 5-star review on the platform you're listening to or watching us on, or share this with a friend or colleague who may find value in the message. See you next time as we keep our pulse on how we can all thrive in the age of AI. Hey, it's Thomas again. One quick question before you go. Are you and your HR team tired of answering the same employee questions again and again in Slack? If yes, our Cleary AI-powered Slackbot is here to help. It takes routine employee requests and answers it automatically while freeing up time for you to take on more important tasks. At the same time, it automatically builds up an HR knowledge base as you go. It's quick to set up, works right in Slack, and you can try it for free. Just head on over to gocleary.com/HR-chatbot to install it. It's again, gocleary.com/HR-chatbot. Thanks again.